having me. It's been a fun conference so far. So yeah, today I'm going to talk about this sort of vague title that I gave. It's mostly going to involve KSC on large scales. Just a little bit about how I ended up doing this. I was doing these large realizations of reionization, and what I wanted to get at was the optical depth. I wanted to see if you could, just from a temperature map, somehow pull out the optical depth variations, which was going to be difficult. And so I wanted to make large full sky maps to look at the optical depth. And then while I was doing it, I realized, well, it's just the linear velocity field, so I can put a linear velocity field in, and then I get sort of the KSE for free. And then while I was doing that, I realized that I had done work a long time ago on the 21 centimeter cross KSZ correlation. So I said, okay, I'll put 21 centimeter in there. And so then I have these three things. And then I ended up thinking a lot about the Doppler effect, which I'll talk about. So here's an outline. So I'll just go through KSE, which is a big part of it on large scales, the simulations, basically large scale structure here is 21 centimeter, but I'll talk about it in a slightly more general sense and then a summary. Okay, so the basics. So here we are. This the secondary anisotropies are generated from the last scattering surface. So you have some patchy process. I'm going to be talking all about EOR, so this is a gigaparsec or so width, maybe two. And so what happens is the primary photons come along. They get scattered with some optical depth along the line of sight, and this is V over C, and you get some effect from the Doppler effect. This should be familiar to all of you. Now, what you can do, though, is a slightly different way to write this, is to separate out this optical depth into a line of sight integral from a mean part, shown here, sort of a visibility function, and then have this specific electron momentum, which captures fluctuations in the momentum, or that's to say fluctuations in the velocity along the line of sight, and also density and ionized fraction. So this is the electron density, because that's what's doing the scattering. So the KSE effect, you have some blob here. This is some large region during reionization. You have H2 regions from rare sources. So this could think about this as an overdensity. And these are the places that will scatter the CMB from all directions into the line of sight and scatter it out from the from where it was coming from in the direction gamma hat. And just like clusters, if they're going away from you, you get a cold spot. And if they're coming towards you, you get a hot spot. Okay. So one important thing is the separation of the electron momentum into so-called longitudinal and transverse parts. So in the linear regime, you only get this longitudinal part due to gravitational instability. But the part we're used to talking about with KSE is the part that arises from the transverse part. And so I'm going to talk about why it is that on small scales, we usually talk about this part. but first, let me just say, so here is the expression again for the electron momentum. So you can separate this vector field out into these two components, as I said. And the important thing to realize here is that over most of the scales of interest, say up to L of a few thousand, the velocity field is linear to a good approximation. These are early times. And the nonlinearities will appear due to the patchiness of reionization, which is this delta X term. And then you'll get some modulations from the linear density field. The density field is a bit less linear, but it's still linear. And this part is what we would call the linear Ostreicher-Vishniac effect. So this first part, since it's linear, you only have this longitudinal. So if you just set the density fluctuations and the ionization fluctuations to zero, you would just get this longitudinal part. And this would be this Doppler thing around L less than 100 or so. And so let me just go into that because that's going to figure into the correlations. These parts, so what you get here is if you have this integrated along the line of sight and then you take a correlation across two different lines of sight separated by some angle, this in K-space becomes a convolution. And this is the Ostreicher-Vishniak term from late 80s. And then this is the patchy reionization, which sometime, say, in the mid-90s was starting to be looked at. Okay, so back to this.
Yeah. Say the B is linear.
Yeah.
So if I write this in perturbation theory, shouldn't I also consider the second order velocity, which is more so the same size as the So the velocity, that's the full velocity. So if you're going to plug in there B times delta in the second term, it would be linear than delta linear. Isn't there, I mean, I should know it, but I don't know.
I haven't. I don't think it's. You're talking about the not the VV, but say V delta, V delta? Or you mean V time V1, V2?
If you are going to plug in V times delta linear here in the thing.
Right.
That's right there. Shouldn't, to be consistent at the same order, also compute the velocity to second order and plug the second order velocity?
Yeah, that's true. But I haven't done it.
Maybe the second order velocity is also then.
Yeah, V1, V2.
In simulation.
I have it. So I don't think it's important because it matches the simulations without it. But let's not get into the simulation. Yeah, so you're talking about a V1 and a V2, and then, yeah, I'm not sure. I'll have to think about that. That's a good point, though. The easier way to think about this longitudinal mode is if you have it, if you think of the observer looking upwards, if you have it skewed, because of course if you had it coming down and you were to think about one mode, there would be no angular variation. So let's just put it like so. So the observer would be down here. So here you have velocity going downwards, velocity going upwards. This is regions of rarefaction here. These are denser regions. So we're going to look across here. And so now imagine that this whole thing is some patch, rather large, but still small on this scale. And then you have a reionization. So what's happening here is that as you come down, the way this is shown is redshift is going up. So as you get more and more electrons, this gets brighter. That's what that's supposed to show. So why have I done this? Because of this cancellation effect. So the important part, the point I'm trying to make here is that here you go, you're going along, you're getting this cancellation, the velocity goes in and out, it cancels, and then it comes along here, it's in mid-cancellation, and then all of a sudden you start losing electrons and you don't cancel as much. And so this shows that the faster you make the reionization transition, the stronger the cancellation is, because you stop it in mid-cancellation. So it's hard to see, but anyway, you get the idea. And this is also shown here. So as you make, and there's a limit. So if you have instantaneous reionization, you reach a limit in this Doppler peak. And then also it shows why this falls off so rapidly, because if you look at much higher angular wave number, this cancellation is much stronger at fixed reionization history. And so as you go to smaller scales, you get more and more cancellation and you fall off. So this is why you see these are rather low L. And of course, we have the primary on top of here. So this is why you're always thinking of the delta V, the Ostreicher. That was Ostreicher and Kaiser's original point, was that at high L, you have to go to this delta V, delta V. This was the first I could find of it, was this not very well cited paper by Sunyaev. It was some kind of conference proceedings. And so all the fancy graphics I just made is summarized here. So here's your visibility function. So what he was saying is if you have some small scale mode, it will cancel. But if you have a larger scale mode with the same variation in the visibility function, it will not cancel. And you can get at recombination, you have a certain thickness, which is in co-moving coordinates is smaller, so it corresponded to some critical size of perturbations that would cancel. And then at reheating, which he had at redshift 11, so he was a little high, is 10 to the 22, so a much larger scale. Okay, so while I was looking at these simulations, which I'll get to, I was trying to understand them, make sure that everything was working, so and knowing that it's a purely linear effect, I figured I could come up with a basic model for it and see how far I could push it to higher L. So the assumptions in this model are that you have linear velocity perturbations, that the bias between the ionized fraction and the density is a linear one. So you just have, in regions that are denser, you get a higher ionized fraction by some amount. And you have a correlation function for the ionization that looks like this, okay? And what this is showing is there's a bubble size here. So this is a correlation function. So what I used for that were measurements that we made of the bubble size. This is as a function of the neutral fraction of the universe. So as you go here, you go towards reionized. This is the percolation. So here is this 10 megaparsecs that Matt had talked about earlier, this typical bubble scale. And then as you get to, say, 90% ionized, you get rather large bubbles. And how large the bubbles are, or how far you can go in ionized regions, depends on the parameters of the model, which have to do with the ionizing photon mean free path, and so on, how rare the sources are. But in any event, given a reionization history, which is put into the model, I can read off one of these models and put in a correlation function for the bubbles. And this gives me the ionization fraction correlation function. And this is just to illustrate, you know, this would be one of the runs we did with the long mean free path. So you see here at fixed ionized fraction, which was 75% ionized, so right here, if you have a long mean free path for the photons, the bubbles are actually bigger, which is not surprising. And so here, the typical distance you can go is a few hundred megaparsecs. And then here, where you have a smaller mean free path for the ionizing photons, the bubbles are correspondingly smaller, and you cannot go as far. So this is just a sort of way to build a model without going to the trouble of doing a simulation every time.
How well does this Gaussian correlation function model work? Which is the figure that you showed to prove that that's a good form?
Yeah, that figure is in process. So
do you really expect it to look like that, or is it just basically that lambda b is a reasonable characteristic scale?
I think lambda b is a reasonable characteristic scale. A lot of the earlier models had this form, but they didn't have lambda b evolving. So they would just add more bubbles of the same size. This is like very early Gruzinoff and Hu type models. I think this, maybe Matt knows as well how well this would do, but I found that it did pretty well. I just don't have I didn't put the plots in this talk, but that it did pretty well for the correlation function, actually. So it has a peak at some scale and it moves over. But I just don't have that to show you.
But so the correlation function is usually that power laws on large scales. So this R is the separation, is that right? Or?
Yeah, this is different because they're bubbles, and so they don't have these tails that you normally think of as power laws.
This is just the correlation function of the ionization factor.
That's right.
So, I mean, larger scales should follow linear density perturbations, like everything else does. So you should get a power law on larger scales.
Right, so on large scales.
This is essentially giving a coherent scale for the size of the bubble. And
right.
We're
talking about the asymptotic form.
Which is the correlation bubble, but that's going to be a relatively small effect.
So maybe by the time it doesn't
that's right.
About it because it's too small. Right?
That's right, too. That's right. But you're pointing out important things.
Usually this type of bubble has like the one bubble term, which is like the bottom one, and then a two bubble term,
Right.
Right. Yes, that's right. But, however, the shape is problematic. The fact that it would be a Gaussian, there's no reason for that at all.
Right. It will break down near percolation. It will be very hard to write in actual. Okay, so but that's what was used in here. And so not to overwhelm you, but this is the separation into a transverse part, which has these second order terms, which are these Ostreicher-Vishniac looking convolutions, and the longitudinal part, which is not a convolution here. And the important thing also is that the longitudinal part depends on how fast reionization happens, which is encoded here. So let me focus on this longitudinal part. So you have this typical integration over the two lines of sight. And then this kernel here. So if you ask how much of this power comes from a given redshift, if you had no reionization, you would get this featureless thing here. But when you have reionization, these factors here, this factor du d chi, which is a modified growth factor version of the visibility function, when you have this reionization, you get a strong peak over what you had if you would just have a uniform non-reionizing universe. And so this feature here, in the part where you do have the reionization history, is strongly localized and gives you a different, smaller scale Doppler peak than what you expect from a Doppler late time Doppler peak. So here's the full results of the analytical model, and this is just sort of to give some intuition. I'll show the results from the Pachi simulations later. So there's no direct comparison here. So here's your Ostreicher-Vishniac. And then the interesting thing to point out here is you have this transition between this Doppler large-scale feature at large scales and then this Pachi higher-order point correlations of Ostreicher-Vishniac and Pachi reionization. And the thing to point out here is that we're used to thinking of the longer duration you have of ionization, the larger KSZ you have, because you're just prolonging the period of patchiness. And patchiness is what gives you these fluctuations on small scales. But it reverses, as I said earlier. And so you have this interesting turnover here, different behavior on large scales. So you see the red one is the more gradual reionization history here. Sort of crazy idea that I was thinking about was, okay, consider now way earlier. So there's just a neutral field. And you have some region that has some overdensity delta star. And it's at some distance, at some redshift z star. And it ionizes very quickly. And it happens to be along the line of sight, such that as photons are coming towards the observer, this region ionizes on a light crossing time. Now, you might think that somehow violates causality or something, but reionization is a locally driven process. So if you have an overdensity here, you have percolation can easily happen faster than the speed of light. So by chance, if, say, you were to have such a region and you had an overdensity, that means matter was going away from you towards the center of the perturbation, as you would expect, so it's contracting. The photons would not get the Doppler boost towards us, but they would see electrons on this side. And so if you just go through it, just a rough order of magnitude, you get features that are, first of all, you see that it's negative, because in general, because it's, you see it on the near side, it's going away from you, so you see some negative amount, and then you have these scalings. It's rather strong redshift, so the higher the redshift it's at, it goes like the square of the size of the bubble, and it goes like linearly related to the density. So how often you get such a bubble along the light cone and so on I'm not sure. So this is just one slide.
What is the velocity?
The velocity? Yeah, the velocity matters. I'm just taking it to be a linear peculiar velocity from a, so just the linear velocity.
Velocity of
magnetization? No. The velocity of the matter of the perturbation, the peculiar velocity. So I'm putting I'm assuming that the bubble or whatever this big thing is at rest with respect to the CMB, but it's contracting. It's growing with the appropriate amount if it's a linear perturbation. So this is.
You need to assume delta starts over density.
10 to the minus 2. Yeah, so this is not a, these are not super, super rare. You can do it, and this is like.
Cold spot,
right? I didn't write cold spot on here. Anyway, so that's that. So here are the simulations. They're large boxes. That's why I wanted to do these full sky realizations to get at the optical depth, like I said earlier. I won't go into too much details of these simulations, except to say that they've been shown by other groups as well that it works fairly well at capturing the patchiness of reionization. Matt's done a lot of work on this. Ferlinetto and company, Andre Messinger, Matthias was the pioneer of this. So that seems to work fairly well. So that's what we do. So just to give you a this is the size of the box. So it's 8 gigaparsecs over H on a side. It's 4096 cubed. So you get 2 megaparsec cells. So that gives you, you know, these 10 megaparsec regions are resolved with 5 cells across. And I do repeat the structure. I don't do any funny things of moving the rotating the boxes or anything. But I figure this should give pretty good correlations up to about 60 degrees and probably a bit better than that, just because you see it really doesn't repeat very much. You are sort of sampling different parts. So here is the KSC that you get. And this is when you set the patchiness equal to 0. So I just found the ionization fraction on average of the box, and then gave every volume at that point along the light cone that ionization fraction, so it's completely uniform. I set the density equal to 0, the density fluctuations equal to 0, so it's only that V term. So this is just the VV, and then when I put the whole thing in, that's what you get. So this is the difference. So this is, all you see here is the addition of the patchy ionization, this high L stuff that we always think about.
There's no primary CMB
here. No, the primary CMB is, 10 times bigger.
Okay, so you haven't added it.
No. That's right. Okay, so this is a zoom in now. So this is 30 degrees across. And this one's interesting because you can see how the large scale Doppler, this velocity field, which is necessary for the effect at all, seeds the small scale fluctuations. And we can see that by, this is if I set the ionization fraction fluctuations to 0. So this is only density fluctuations. You get this. This peaks at relatively smaller scales and is roughly similar to the patchy part. This is the patchy part, which is on a bit larger scales. Okay, so here's the Doppler part. So you see, it's interesting. You can kind of make out like, so in a region that's either going away from you, going away from you or towards you, you see that these large scale velocity modes source the small scale fluctuations. This is the total. That doesn't help. This one. So this is when you subtract off the large scale modes. And you see, it's not a perfect thing because it's not necessarily the case, but generally you can sort of make out very roughly places where you source the small scale fluctuations. This is the power spectrum. So by separating out the different components, by just doing this, and since I can control in the integration along the line of sight which terms are included, it's pretty easy just to separate out the different contributions to the power spectrum. So these are the actual contributions from those maps. So this is the analytical thing, which was the formula I showed you CL parallel. That's the red one, and these are just cosmic variants, fluctuations, what you would expect. And the dots are the measured ones. And then here I just bend them up, and you see, and the total is the solid. So you see it matches pretty well. This was also just a diagnostic to make sure everything was being integrated along the line of sight properly. And then you have this Ostreicher-Vishniac, which comes along here. You saw that it was really small scale. And then those patchiness kicks in around here. That's this one. And then this, I think, is due to cross terms, delta, delta x, and then there's different cross terms. But mostly it's the correlation of density with itself and patchiness with itself that pretty much makes the signal. Okay, so that's the KSC. So now just to talk about, of course, it's buried underneath the primary at those scales, so it's about a one sigma effect in terms of cosmic variance. If just trying to detect that the Doppler peak has about a one sigma effect. Now, but in general, if you ask, if I have some tracer that I integrate along the line of sight of density, so I have delta with some window function w, it could be a delta function if you just had a. This one is 0.09. Tau of 0.09, so reionization redshift of about 10. It's lower. So I did have plots of the, this peak goes like tau squared. It's so for the Planck for 0.07 or so, it's 15. It's here. So it goes like tau squared.
How about the plateau?
The plateau is trickier because it doesn't just depend on tau, it depends on delta z, and then it depends on how you measure delta z, whether it's from 0.1 to 0.9, or, but it depends on the duration at fixed tau.
I guess the tau squared scaling of the low peak means that it's the high redshift.
Yes. In fact, that's right. That's because the velocity is not growing very much. It's mostly that for a given co-moving distance, the density is going up. So you get, it's just like the tau integral, and it's similar for the velocity. Anyhow, so you have a tracer, which means you just, you have something that you can bend along line of sight, integrate up, and then you cross-correlate it. And so, whereas before we had two terms here proportional to how fast reionization happens, we now have one, which is this Doppler, this one. And by the way, this is just for this large scale now. And then you have this tracer, okay? And so we're getting at 21 centimeter here. So if I look at this, again, here's the du dz. And so the interesting part is, if you look at this function, which really controls the sign of the correlation, when reionization is happening, this means that the cross correlation between a density tracer and the large scale Doppler KSC is negative. As was the case for that big spherical H2 region that I said was generically cold spots. It's an overdensity. It's the same idea. And then at low redshift, it turns the other way around. So the sign of the correlation is sensitive to whether reionization is happening or not. And just to sort of drive that home, so I showed this earlier, and now I just want to show what happens, whoops, I'm almost. So this was going towards us, and the red is going away from this. This is rarefaction, and this is compression. And you're looking at something at the rescattering surface, so to speak, of reionization. And so you want to keep canceling out and get just as much red stuff as you had blue stuff, but that doesn't happen. So when you cancel, you're in the middle of a rarefaction, and so you get this anti-correlation. This is a hot spot is anti-correlated with a cold spot. Okay, so these are the maps. I already showed you that one. These are the other ones. They have more small-scale power. these are the different cross, these are every possible correlation you can make out of it. Here's the thing that I showed we've been looking at. And you see here tau, the optical depth, that's like some weighted version of that delta. And it's positively correlated with the density. So that's the anti-correlation. But the 21 centimeter, which is shown here as 140 megahertz, the 21 centimeter is the opposite. Regions that are high in density are actually cold in 21 centimeter. So it becomes a positive correlation. It flips. Yeah, this is not necessary. Okay, so then I took that map, and what I did was first I calculated. Wait, this should be. Oh no, oh there it is. Okay, the cross correlation coefficient. This PP is primary. So what happens is you have 21 centimeter, which is nu cross KSZ, and the basically your signal to noise in a given mode is given by this cross correlation coefficient when it's weak. And so here you see per mode, like any given mode doesn't have a signal to noise of one, but because you're looking at something which is evolving along redshift, you can just imagine if you do the cross correlation of 21 centimeter at a given redshift, you can sum up all the modes. That would be one way to think of it.
Is that cosmic variance limited?
Yes, cosmic variance limited. That's a big caveat. Yeah, thanks. So this is the correlation. As I said, it's a positive correlation. The black line is just binned up, so it peaks around L of 100. And so this is, I just did a bunch of, I added a bunch of random realizations of the primary and summed up the total amount of power and saw how much it varied. And if you sum up to around L of 300, you get a signal to noise of about 8. Now if you bin them up, so now I can do this cross correlation with maps that are binned in frequency. So this was with delta nu of 10 megahertz, which is I think like, if I want to say 50 megaparsecs, you can correct me if I think that I'm remembering that right. So rather, well, medium-sized bins, I would say. And the important thing here is that you see that if you had cosmic variance limited 21 centimeter observations over the full sky and CMB, you could detect it at this sort of significance. If you could somehow do something to reconstruct the temperature fluctuations, say from polarization with the TE correlation, you could get maybe another factor of maybe a 2 out of it. And so in principle, it's totally possible. I calculated, I don't have it here, but I also calculated the tau. If you just take tau, so if you were able to reconstruct tau somehow and cross-correlate it with the temperature, which would be quite difficult, it's almost the same. Everything's almost the same, and that's because it's still looking at density fluctuations. For the 21 centimeter, you're not sensitive to. It's not that you need the low K parallel as you would think, because that effect is coming from that visibility function changing very quickly. So you just need the K perpendicular. You need to know that in one place you have an overdensity, and in another place angular correlation wise.
But visibility function is not much, but density of one.
This the binning.
Well, I mean just two.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah, delta Z of one. That's right.
K parallel, you don't need 0, but you still need only 0.01 or something.
No, this is the cross correlation.
I understand. But if I have if I'm limited to k is bigger than 1, for example, k parallel is bigger than 1 megaparsec inverse, you would think the silly erases all the signal, wouldn't it? I mean, in fact, going from just looking at the width of this function, I would say you have to go to a k parallel of probably 0.01. in order to have a chance of seeing it, don't you?
A K parallel of 0.01. So that's so like hundreds of megaparsecs.
That's right, because these are wide redshift bins. If I tell you that my experiment is sensitive to nothing with a K parallel less than 0.01, would that signal still exist?
So that's right. So if it was not sensitive to anything with k less than 0.01.
Yeah, for example, I think that's kind of, you know.
Well, it would still be okay, because this is smaller than that. But So maybe, but if what you say is probably correct if you change it to 0.05 or something.
I don't understand where K parallel comes in. On the left, you just have the harmonic mode. So
yeah, that's what you would think. But I think what Weili is saying is when you do your binning up of the frequency bins in a given delta nu, how do you know that what you get is really coming from that frequency bin? Because you have these.
You can only measure differences in flux and frequency. You can never measure the actual mean flux at 120 megahertz. That's not observable. You can measure the difference between 120 and 121, right?
Right.
So certainly that was the assumption, was that that you could somehow get rid of foregrounds at this binning level. But the more general case is that that this correlation does exist and that it's of the nature that I described. And so that's it. I'll just leave it at that so we can get going.
I did have an answer to that question. So B at all orders of perturbation theory has no curl because of Kelvin circulation. That's why you don't have to worry about it.
But you still would get the
B2 still has no curl because of Kelvin circulation theorem, but all orders in perturbation theorem. So that's why you never have to worry about these terms. And that's why your simulation agrees.
You're answering the BV question.
Yeah, I'm answering the B2 question, not the BV question.
But there is a curl, it's just not linear.
There's no curl, but in linear perturbation theory, Kelvin circulation theorem, there's probably no curl to all orders. Now,
all
breaks down, but not in this context.
I want to go to the back.
Thank everybody.